Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the president unveils his deficit plan, Palestinians bid for full membership at the UN, markets reel, two young Americans go free. The president moves to take on the deficit, says the country can't have the investments it needs and low taxes on the wealthy.
We can't afford to do both. This is not class warfare. It's math.
At the UN, Palestinians make a statehood move for full membership. French President Nicolas Sarkozy had this advice for Israel.
Vous ne pouvez pas rester immobile.
You can't remain immobile when this wind of freedom and democracy is blowing in your region.
And in Afghanistan, peace talks leader and former president Burhanuddin Rabbani is assassinated in a suicide attack.
This man put explosives inside his turban, says an aide. He put his head right on Rabbani's chest, and he blew up his bomb.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Brian Monroe of CNNPolitics.com, David Sanger of The New York Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? The president's deficit plan, the Palestinian bid, the execution of Troy Davis. You can comment at our website as well, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We are broadcasting today from the big online news association conference going on in Boston. 1,000 online journalists trying to figure out the future. It is great to be here. All right, digital, here we come. With me at the table today, Brian Monroe, Pulitzer Prize-winning editor at CNNPolitics.com. He had the first interview with Barack Obama after his election as president and the last with Michael Jackson before his death. That's a range. He was also president of the National Association of Black Journalists. Brian Monroe, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
With us, wired in from Washington, is the great David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. He's author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and Challenges to American Power. Plenty of those right now. David Sanger, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
And with us here at the Digital News Conference, On Point's Uber digital man, Jack Beatty. Jack, great to
have
you.
Hello, Tom, David, and Brian. Welcome.
Let me come to everybody first off, just on the markets this week. I mean, here we had the president coming out with his big plan for the American deficit, saying we're going to get on top of it. We'll talk about that. But then the Fed comes out and says, we have more tools in our kit bag. We're going to do the twist, bring down long-term rates. And the next thing you know, David Sanger, we've got markets all over the world absolutely plummeting. Biggest two-day drops since 2008. What is going on with global confidence when it comes to markets and economy, David?
Well, I think two things are going on. First was that what was significant on the Fed announcement, I think, was less the action they said they were going to take, because they don't have a whole lot left in their arsenal, than their predictive sentence in there, that they thought that there was significant downside risk, which the markets read as greater and greater chances of a double-dip recession. That's the first. The second is that the situation in Europe has gotten significantly worse. While the Europeans are describing a system to stave off a bankruptcy, essentially, in Greece, that could have effects on market confidence throughout Europe, the fact of the matter is very few Europeans I talk to believe that this will work, that the Greek government is capable of making the kind of changes that the bailout would require, and that right now all they are doing is delaying the inevitable. And there's a big debate underway about whether, if in fact it's inevitable, people should just let it happen and get behind it.
Let it happen, maybe. Brian, I was talking with a Swedish banker just last night who said they're all assuming at this point Greece is the default's coming. Very likely they will be out. In that case, double dip may be the least of it. I mean, it seems that the markets are fearing more than a double dip. The growth is so low right now that it's hardly happening at all. There seems to be the fear of something bigger and worse out there, potentially, Brian.
Well, in a way, the markets have told us, particularly looking at the European situation, that it's not all about us. Mm-hmm. That the Europeans, the Greeks, they are they've got some things going on over there that will have serious ramifications, not just domestically here in the U.S., but across the planet. I think the issue in Greece was not about default. I think many people are assuming that that is going to happen. It was all about, will it be an orderly default? Will their issues be managed in a way that wouldn't be too detrimental on the rest of their neighbors? And, you know, if they can manage that process, it may minimize what could be a catastrophic situation. But either way, it's going
to
be bad.
Banker that I talked to said at this point they think the default's coming. They won't bail out Greece, but they may have to put together, probably will, to deal with the banks in Europe and maybe beyond, because the vulnerability there is so great. The Fed jumping in this week to say, we're going to try and scooch down long-term interest rates. Maybe that will help on mortgages, home loans, and all the rest and get things going. But here's a little tape from Kenneth Polcari, managing director of ICAP Securities, telling AP that driving interest rates down to historic lows, and that's where they're headed, won't necessarily get banks to make more loans.
Investors do not want to lend money out today at 3% for 30 years because everyone's assuming the next 6 or 8 months or year that rates are going to go higher, and nobody wants to be caught having loaned money for 30 years at 3%.
Don't want to loan money for 30 years at 3% if they're going higher. The Fed, there's a limit to what it can do. David Sanger, I mean, they like to talk as though they have more tools there, but many people are saying we are at the limits now of monetary policy as we look at the potential for another economic downturn.
Well, we are at the limits, and Tom, you and I both have had experience in Japan, which similarly lowered rates down to zero when they faced a complete property bust. And it's not clear that just lowering the rates alone will do what you need to do, which is spur demand by getting people buying these properties again. Why is that? First, because prices in many markets for real estate are still falling. And if that's the case, people are going to be hesitant to go in until they think the market has reached a bottom. Secondly, if you're concerned about your job, if you're worried that it may go away in a year, if you think that your income is stagnant, given the experience of the past 3 years, you might be a whole lot less tempted to take on a new debt, even at historically low interest rates. So this may spur a little bit of refinancing, which has the ability of pumping some money into the economy because it frees up money people are otherwise paying unnecessarily in interest. But it's not clear to me that it's necessarily going to spur demand.
Concerns about that in the United States, Europe with its own set of concerns that, as Brian says, could spill over all over the place. Asia, markets way down there as well. Into all this, President Obama jumped even before the market week really began with his deficit reduction plan. He laid it all out the week after he said pass this bill on jobs. Class warfare was a big response from the GOP. The president sort of went right to the heart of it, spoke yesterday from the Brent Spence Bridge in Cincinnati, a bridge in disrepair. It just happens to connect the home states of House Speaker John Boehner, Ohio, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Kentucky. The president there pushed back against charges that his deficit plan represents class warfare.
If asking a billionaire to pay their fair share of taxes, to pay the same tax rate as a plumber or a teacher, is class warfare, then you know what? I'm a warrior for the middle class. I'm happy to fight for the middle class. I'm happy to fight for working people.
Brian, we all saw the package he laid out. We all saw the response. And now here's the president. Is this the tee up for the 2012 campaign? Is this what it's going to be fought over? Can we afford to wait for that fight to get something going under this flagging U.S. economy?
Well, I think it's you've seen a different President Obama come out in the last few weeks with his jobs plan, the deficit reduction package. And he, I think, has realized that playing nice is not getting the results that that the country needs. And so he's taking a much more aggressive stance. Certainly it plays to his political base in a strong way. Whether or not it will end up generating the results the economy needs is a big question, because Republicans are going to be hesitant to give him what he wants, if not downright resistant.
David Sanger, there's a sense of unreality here. The president of the United States lays out his plan. Of course, there's no obligation on anybody's part to take it and pass it straight through. On the other hand, what else is happening? And here's the economy teetering. How do you read the picture of Washington, not just the Fed, but beyond on the economy? Is it sit on hands until November 2012?
Well, there's a good deal of that going on because there's reason for freeze on both sides. The Republicans, on the one hand, while I think many are reluctant to go say this, see some advantage in sitting on their hands, because in the end, this is President Obama's economy, and he'll be have to take responsibility for it in the election. So I don't see the Republicans rushing to look for new and innovative ideas. At the same time, while President Obama won't put it in these terms, what this is a second form of stimulus. Now, you can argue, and I have some sympathy with this argument, that the problem with the first stimulus was that it was too small, not that it was too large. I mean, the Chinese did one at the same time that was a much bigger proportion of their economy, and it worked out a whole lot better for them.
Building high-speed railroads and everything all over the place there.
And just making sure that workers who had been sent home from the factories on the in the southern coast ended up getting drawn back in. But that said, no one in the Democratic Party wants to be pinned with another big stimulus where they are charged with once again spending money that the government doesn't have and must borrow. So you've got this split between what most economists will tell you, which is you don't want to dampen demand in the midst of a potential second recession. If anything, you want to boost the demand up, and that's the lesson of what happened in 1937. What politicians are saying, which is that they're having a very hard time getting their constituents to think about the difference between short-term spending and long-term deficit reduction.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at a week in the news, Obama's deficit plan, markets reeling, Palestinians at the UN, Don't Ask, Don't Tell is over. This is a special broadcast of On Point, live from this year's big online news association conference in Boston, here today with digital journalists from around the country and the world. It's great to be with you all. With us today from Washington, David Sanger, Pulitzer Prize-winning chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Right with me right here at the table at the digital conference is Brian Monroe. He is editor of CNNpolitics.com, Pulitzer Prize winner himself, and our own news analyst Jack Beatty is here. Jack, here we are looking at this economy. We've got a lot to look at here today, but here's the president, the other Republicans last night. Here's this economy sitting in front of us just teetering. What do you see coming?
Well, let's just imagine a counterfactual. Okay. Let's suppose that 2 weeks ago when the president announced his plan, he said not $400 billion stimulus, but $1 trillion stimulus. And to be paid for not just by raising taxes on the rich, but by eliminating all of the Bush tax cuts on all the rest of us.
So we would all pay more taxes, whatever
right.
the income.
That to happen when unemployment reaches 5%. Or 2014, whichever comes sooner. And suppose...
They would come back up when people had jobs.
That's
again.
It.
Okay.
And let's just imagine that the Republican Party said, by God, the country is in such straits. We're going to join with the president and commit to this program. Economists say it would create the jobs. It would get the... Now, you know, the markets run on animal spirits. Think what that would do to flagging animal spirits. My point is, our circumstances are not fate. These are plastic circumstances. These are man-made events. They can be changed. And I think one of the problems now dogging the whole world economy is this sense that we're fated, that politics can't work to change the direction of history. And I think if you just imagine that counterfactual, you immediately see, yes, the problem is politics. And you know, David said the Republicans don't want to help the president. No, but they don't seem to want to help the country either.
Well, I mean, they would put it quite differently. They'd say the only way to help the country is to get this spending down, and we're absolutely firm on that. David Sanger, you're right there in Washington watching all this. Does it have the feeling of sort of marching, prisoner of ideology or politics? Without acting? Are the politics themselves the plastic circumstances here? Are we ignoring levers we could pull to make things better?
Well, so much of what happens in the American economy, as in any economy, is a matter of psychology. That's why we measure consumer confidence and things mm-hmm. like that. That's why we look at the markets as a bet on the future. And almost nothing that has happened in the political sphere since the debate, or even during the debate on the debt limit going forward, has inspired any confidence that the whole country can get behind a single strategy, whether it's a good strategy or a bad strategy. And that has, in fact, led to this sense of complete gridlock. Now, there are moments when gridlock is your friend. You know, if you're worried about spending going out of control, then gridlock can be a way of containing spending. But when you are trying to instill market confidence, gridlock only creates an impression that no one is in charge. And in this case, that impression may well be correct.
Florence, South Carolina. Scott's calling. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, everyone. I was going to ask, the first nearly $1 trillion of stimulus, why wasn't this bridge problem addressed then when, instead of now, the president holding over Boehner and McConnell's head? Why now?
That's a good question. You know, why wasn't the president standing on that bridge when the eight hundred billion, nearly trillion, whatever? When, you know, Scott, you hear the skepticism
because
there.
It makes a great photo op today.
Wow.
It is politics, and that's the other piece of this game. You know, going back to what David said, though, it's fascinating. As important as fiscal policy and stimulus or restriction on spending is, what's going to get this economy started or restarted are the jobs. And secondly, demand and spending. And as important and powerful as the federal government is, that really resides in the private sector. And it's the private sector, the banks, the big companies who have gotten billions of dollars in breaks, billions of dollars in the trickle-down money from the banking system, for instance, that has not gone back into investment into small businesses. They've held on to that money. Dropping the interest rates that will happen will hit their bottom line quite well. But will that then impact spending and hiring and investment to get people hired? And that's going to be the real problem, because Boehner or Obama can go round and round and round. But until the store up the street hires more people because people are spending more money, nothing will happen.
Keynes would say, government spend money, that gets those jobs out there, that gets the pump primed. Republicans talking very differently last night at their GOP debate sponsored by Fox News and Google in Orlando. Here was former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney with presenting a list of what he would do to stimulate job growth.
Small business pays at the highest rate. We need to get those rates down to globally competitive levels. Number two, government and regulators have to be allies of business, not foes. Number three, we've got to become energy secure in this country. Number four, we have to have trade policies that work for us, not just for the other guys, and crack down on cheaters like China.
And crack down on cheaters like China. He's got alliteration going there. David, do you see a solid front on the Republican side on what they would do with this economy, and does it make sense to you? The UK and others in Europe have had austerity and haven't had good growth, but the UK is sticking with its austerity. Is that the way to go here, the Romney plan?
Well, as you point out, the Europeans have tried an all-austerity method, and so far, except in Germany, we have not seen where a good deal of that growth is coming from. And, of course, the concern now is that as the U.S. market and, to some degree, the Asian markets turn down, exports are going to begin for Germany and others to decline, and you're going to see a great difficulty there. But, no, on the overall plans that we have heard on the Republican side, and even some on the Democratic, you have not heard any particularly new ideas on how one is going to bring about the growth. I mean, we had in that clip that you played from Mr. Romney, you had a case being made for reforming trade agreements. But it's not clear that any of those kinds of reforms would happen in the time period you need to revive the economy. So there's a lot of discussion of long-term things that the United States has to set in order, and they're all important. But what you have not heard from any of those candidates, and I didn't hear it in the debate last night, was any real strategy of what you do over the next year or two to spur growth.
We'll look more at the debate last night. A couple of calls here. Terry in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Terry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
My question was the Republican stand on the debt ceiling, which devastated every American in its own beliefs of a positive thought pattern for, you know, our government.
You mean over the summer when they drew the line at the debt ceiling and pushed things right to the limit? We had our downgrade.
Well, right, and along with that, I mean, would anybody else think like I do that was the wrong decision to do, and that's basically what we're experiencing now all over the globe, is insecurities that the other countries looking to us as a follower, to follow that because of our weakness that we showed there, and that it didn't just give the United States citizens their doubts on how strong our government could agree on anything, but it also lowered the thoughts across the globe.
Maybe globally. Now we've got downgrades on French banks in the last week or two. I mean, Jack, part of it is psychological. Part of it's real.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Britain may have its trouble with its austerity, but it's trying to bring those things down here. You've got European countries with much higher percentage of GDP debt than we have, and we see the trouble they're in. I mean, can you blame the Republicans for saying, we just don't trust that this government can ever rein itself in? Even with President Obama's plan, a trillion five of that three-something trillion savings was ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Or are we supposed to assume they would go on forever?
That's absolutely right. No, I mean, that is sophistry. No, I mean, they have a case, I suppose, but let's look at it in more detail. The Republicans object to the Federal Reserve doing what it can to refloat this economy. This week, three of their leaders sent a letter, unprecedented, according to David's paper, to Mr. Bernanke, saying, don't do any more with the economy. The Republican candidates have slammed, Rick Perry says, you come down to Texas and we know how to treat you down there.
Pretty ugly.
So, and they're against a stimulative fiscal policy. Remember, the president, half of the stimulus, or 40% of it, were tax cuts. They, Republicans, universally were against all that. So they're against stimulative fiscal policy. They're against accommodative monetary policy. It sounds like they're for the recession, because those are the only ways you get out of a recession.
Well, Brian, can't you have some sympathy with a party that looks at debt and how it's grown and grown and grown and just doesn't believe that it's going to be cut without some drastic measures? That's what the whole Tea Party uprising has been about.
We had a CNN Tea Party debate last Monday where a lot of those issues were talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the questions that keeps coming back up is, this didn't start 2 years ago. This didn't start on January 21st, 2009. The deficits have grown over the last several decades. And, you know, with the exception of the Clinton administration, where they actually declined, we had a surplus. This was not a recent invention. And so to think that it can be instantly wiped away with the flick of a pen is ridiculous. But more importantly, it gets back to consumer confidence. And I think what's going to happen over these next few weeks and few months between now and Christmas will tell us a lot about where this country is going, whether we are going down into a deeper recession or whether we'll pick back up. You've got
retailers already worrying about that season.
Yeah, you've got the Apple iPhone, the new iPhone 5 coming out in a couple of weeks. Will that help get consumer confidence back up? You've got Christmas
but
season.
What percentage of the country is buying Apple iPhones?
That's what I mean.
Sector that is lining up, but there's a whole lot who can't even.
But
think
it shows
about it.
It's one of those things that you don't have to have. Well, a few of us nerds have to have them, but everyone else, you don't have to have one of those. This Christmas is going to be the biggest selling season for tablets, or not. But for most people,
you're talking about the sector that President Obama wants to tax,
right,
now.
But for a lot of those people, those are discretionary purchases.
Mm-hmm.
And if people are spending money on discretionary purchases, we might be okay. If they're deferring that, that's an indicator of bigger problems.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Jeff is calling. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you think, Jeff? What do you see?
I was just questioning the Republican stance on not to raise taxes. I just wanted to know how they plan to generate the revenue needed without increasing taxes at all. The Buffett rule, I know, is a hot topic right now, and if you have people willing to pay more taxes to do their part, I don't see why that's such a bad thing to maybe get the economy going a little bit and helping out the little guy.
Well, Jeff, thanks for your call. David Sanger, they would say very straightforwardly, the way is to cut spending.
Yeah, they would, but nobody has sort of explained yet, if you cut the spending at the public in the public sector, and you've got declining spending happening in the private sector because you don't have companies willing to go higher at this moment because they don't see enough demand, I don't see just an explanation of where the growth comes from. So it's one thing to walk away from Keynesian economics. It's another thing to explain what theory you are then going to rely on? And that's what we haven't heard yet.
It was more than economics at the debate in Orlando last night. People really gunning for Rick Perry, going after him, I should say. The Texas governor there criticized from all sides. Mitt Romney went after him for his home state's, authored by him, policy of offering in-state tuition rates to the children of illegal immigrants. Really pounded on it. Governor Perry right here pounded back, defended the policy.
But if you say that we should not educate children who have come into our state for no other reason than they've been brought there by no fault of their own, I don't think you have a heart. We need to be educating these children because they will become a drag on our society.
Jack Beatty, some really interesting moments there last night. Here's now George W. Bush was also living in Texas on the border, understood some realities there. Here's the Texas governor again saying, come on, break out of orthodoxy, but others attacking him on that. Perry sounding a little bit more like a Democrat, maybe there. At other moments last night, Mitt Romney sounding
like the Democrat.
What did you see on that front last night, Jim?
Yes, you know, I thought Governor Perry's point that this was practically a unanimous vote in the Texas State Senate for this bill, that really tells you something. I mean, Texans see this in a very different way. On the other hand, I thought Rick Santorum made a good point when he said, wait a minute, the alternative isn't that these people will become charges on the taxpayer. Let them, or, you know, that they won't go to school. Let them take out loans. Let them do what other people are doing and pay their way. Why should they get a privilege since they, you know, they're not here legally? But certainly that was his Democratic moment. Mitt Romney's, of course, is Social Security. The Governor Perry talks about
Ponzi scheme.
Ponzi scheme, returning it to the states. It's unconstitutional and so on. And Romney has been hitting him with that. On the other hand, you know, that may not be the best issue in a Republican primary electorate. That's a Democratic issue. And Republicans like Social Security. Polls show that. But I think there's a subset of Republicans, conservatives, who in their heart of heart think the whole idea is a little dubious. Social Security? I have individual security. I look after myself. That there's something in it that the conservatism in America, rightly or wrongly, the principle of it bothers them, the transfer payment principle. And Romney may be pushing on the wrong button.
Brian Monroe, does Mitt Romney move closer to a Republican nomination when he goes after Rick Perry calling Social Security a Ponzi scheme?
Well, it's actually fascinating. If you look at last night and over the last few weeks, there has become a very clear distinction emerging between Perry and Romney. Remember at the beginning of this race, it was Romney's race to lose. Bachman jumped in, took some heat for a while. She's kind of faded back. Perry's now in and dominating. Romney has stepped up. He has turned into a much more of a street fighter than you would first think was there. And you know, we've got a piece that's leading CNNpolitics.com today about some of the things we've learned. And I think one of them is that, as they say, it's on. This is the race is on. Also, Huntsman last night, he's not out yet. You know, he had some issues earlier this week with some campaign staffers leaving, part of a transition in a campaign. But he was fierce. Santorum stood up. This race is long, has a long way to go. And I think it's turning into a brawl between Perry and Huntsman.
Really?
I mean, Perry and Romney.
really interesting to watch. We'll hear a little bit more from Huntsman. We've got much more to look at here. We're broadcasting live today from the Online News Association conference, big conference going on this week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're broadcasting today from the Online News Association conference in Boston. In other news this week, two young American hikers were cheered by friends and relatives as they touched down in Oman after more than 2 years in an Iranian prison. Standing next to Josh Fatal, 29-year-old Shane Bauer was thrilled to be out.
2 years in prison is too long, and we sincerely hope for the freedom of other political prisoners and other unjustly imprisoned people in America and Iran.
A World War II-era fighter plane crashed at the stands at an air show in Reno, killing 11. A witness recounted the shock in the crowd.
We didn't have time to be terrified. It was just so fast.
And rock band REM is breaking up after more than 31 years. Lead singer Michael Stipe said it was just time.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's
We're looking at a week in the news. Obama's deficit plan, markets reeling, Palestinians at the UN. Don't Ask, Don't Tell is over. With David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, author of The Inheritance. He's with us today from Washington. With me at the table here, Brian Monroe, editor of CNNpolitics.com. Our own Jack Beatty's here. David Sanger, if we can, move to the UN. Everything going on there today, before the day is out, the Palestinian leader will make his appeal for that full UN membership and the kind of implication of statehood that goes along with it. President Obama said, we will stand by Israel. How do you read what is unfolding here, David?
Well, President Obama is in a very tough spot here. Last year, he went to the UN and made the argument that if there was significant progress in the negotiations with Israel, this year you could see the Palestinians applying for membership in the UN. There was no progress, and you've seen the application anyway. So this time the president has had to stand up and say that he would oppose this because it was an effort to forestall a real negotiated solution. What he couldn't say was that within the administration, they're highly critical of Prime Minister Netanyahu for his refusal to get involved in serious negotiations here. And it's very possible the Palestinians would not have been capable of coming to a negotiated case anyway. But what this vote does is it jams the system. And if President Obama is perceived among the Palestinian people to be blocking the move to statehood, you could see a moment where this could get very dangerous and you could see people back out on the streets.
It's a global world, a global media world. Everybody's watching. Just after his speech at the UN, here were Palestinian protesters in Gaza City chanting, listen, listen, Obama, we want a free state. They are watching, the whole Arab Spring, Middle East watching as well. Here was the president before the UN General Assembly on Wednesday, said that the Palestinian appeal to the UN would not produce a peaceful resolution in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Now, I know that many are frustrated by the lack of progress. I assure you, so am I. But the question isn't the goal that we seek. The question is, how do we reach that goal? And I am convinced that there is no shortcut to the end of a conflict that has endured for decades. Peace is hard work. Peace will not come through statements and resolutions at the United Nations. If it were that easy, it would have been accomplished by now.
Would have been accomplished by now. He was chided in the streets of Gaza City, but right over his shoulder there at the UN, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu commended him for his stance on the Palestinians' bid for a UN seat.
I think that standing your ground, taking this position of principle, which is also, I think, the right position to achieve peace, I think this is a badge of honor. And I want to thank you for wearing that badge of honor, and also to express my hope that others will follow your example, Mr. President.
A big thanks right there from Netanyahu. We'll see how this plays out. Of course, it goes right into politics. Speaking alongside a group of conservative Orthodox Jewish leaders in New York on Tuesday, GOP presidential candidate Texas Governor Rick Perry slammed President Obama's overall Mideast policy.
The Obama policy of moral equivalency, which gives equal standing to the grievances of Israelis and Palestinians, and including the orchestrators of terrorism, is a very dangerous insult. There is no middle ground between our allies and those who seek their destruction.
No middle ground and a big gap opening up here. Wow, here we are. I mean, people talking in really worried terms about what this means for the United States and the Middle East, but how do you read politically what's going on with this, Brian?
Well, it's interesting watching Rick Perry in New York this week. Perry is not a Johnny-come-lately to the Israeli issue. He has been over there several times, probably more times than President Obama, and has had long and deep relationships with the Israeli people and the government. But that said, he is playing politics. He is trying to set it up as another divisive issue. And at the same time, there are those Israeli supporters domestically here in the U.S. and over there who are upset with President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton for allowing this to get to this point. that this really should have been dealt with a month or two or three ago, so it never would have come to the showdown this week. They averted the short-term thing. Doubtful there'll be the vote that was worried about today. But what's really going to happen is if President Obama is seen as having to veto in the Security Council a move, that still leaves open at the General Assembly the acceptance with a yes vote, and that would give the Palestinians a permanent position similar to what the Vatican is, of an observer state.
And with that state word right in there, Jack Beatty, should have been dealt with months ago. But how? How? With all the ways in which American policy is fringed around on this?
You know, I think what we're seeing here is that that American politics has really made it all but impossible for an American president, at least in his first term, to advance American interests in the Middle East. Look at what happened to President Obama. To make a gesture toward the Palestinians a year and a half ago or more, he wanted a freeze on settlements. Benjamin Netanyahu not only rejected that, he went to the Congress and they got a massive resolution and many, many, you know, standing ovations. And essentially the president backed down. And this earlier this year, there was a U.S. veto of a censure of the settlements. We vetoed it. It's not in our interest to veto it. I mean, let's be candid. The Palestinians are feeling more and more desperate. More and more of that land, whoever land it winds up being, is disappearing under these settlements. And our government, which should be stopping that, and saying, okay, we're going to work with what we have, with swaps and so on. The president is paralyzed. He can't make a move here because of the Congress won't let him. And then now the Republican Party really sees an opening here. They had they won a seat in New York where this issue was
front
crucial.
And center.
Yeah. And so now it's become
an issue.
Yeah, it's become an even hotter issue. So I was glad to see the French president step up. Let France deal with this. Let someone else deal with it. American presidents in their first term just can't.
David Singer, how do you see the issue of U.S. interests as this play unfolds?
Well, there are, I think, two separate issues. One we've gotten at a little bit here, which is the bind that the president finds himself in, which is that from the Republican right, the case has been made that he is not supporting Israel enough. And in the Middle East, the argument is that he has sided with Israel far too much here and that the Palestinians don't believe that he actually is coming in the way he portrayed himself at the beginning of this process as a neutral arbiter. And if you don't have the Palestinians believing that, then it's very hard for the U.S. to be in this lead position of the U.S. has always been in, which is that any of these negotiations have Israel, the Palestinians, and the United States guiding it. So that takes you to the second question, which is, can the French guide it? And I suspect not. I suspect that they will not have the clout in the region and that the suspicions that both sides will have, but particularly the Israelis have, about European sympathies with the Palestinians will make it a very difficult place to be.
In that case, the U.S. will, one presumes, lead the rejection in the Security Council here, whether that's by veto or assembling votes to do it.
They would prefer to do is just put this thing off. I mean, they're hoping that there's no way the U.S. can stop this in the General Assembly. In the Security Council, there are a lot of things they can do to keep it from coming up. Now, whether those will be successful depends on how many other members of the Security Council they can bring in to the idea of not letting this on the agenda.
But what about do you see a hit to U.S. interests here? I mean, there's, as if that's the whole thing. You've got all kinds of interests here, not least the whole Arab Spring push that's going on. But what about, and of course, Israel always focused on survival interests and more. But what about U.S. interests in the midst of all this, David?
I think that the biggest concern that the U.S. has for its own interests here is that the U.S. has had a very difficult time convincing the Middle East that it's on the right side of history in the Arab Spring. We're a little bit reluctant on Egypt, got around to the right place. In Libya, got around to the right place. But in the cases of Bahrain, for example, place where the U.S. has got bases, there has been much less of a U.S. push for democratic values. And I think that the concern that many may have is that the U.S. will lose some more influence in the Middle East if it appears not to be on the side of greater reform and democracy in the case of the Palestinians as well as the other Arab states.
Let's go to a caller in Wake Forest, North Carolina. Stuart's calling. Hi, Stuart. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen. I just want to say, being Jewish, being American, and having been to Israel many times, I think just about everybody, especially the politicians, look at this from a totally wrong aspect. Now, if you really go to Israel and really go into neighborhoods and talk, they want peace, the Israelis. They have been under a war state for over 60 years, and they're fed up with it. Nobody should be subjected to that. So I believe the Palestinians should be given their own state, make them feel proud of their own state, and I believe it'll delegitimize Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, and any of the Arab countries that still feel Israel shouldn't exist, because they will take the step and they will develop peace. And the reality is they won't be any less secure, because in this day and age, it's not going to be a land war with tanks anymore. It's going to be nukes.
But Stuart, I mean, that's a forbidding prospect. But how does anybody get there? President Obama talked in that direction and really got slammed politically in this country. You saw the vote in New York last week. How do you get to that place?
You know, I don't know how to get to it, but I have to say that as being Jewish, I fear evangelical Christians more than I fear Palestinians and Muslims.
But they line up with Israel very solidly on this. Rick Perry at the lead last week.
But there's a reason why. Their reason is based on, say, Christian theology. Without a whole Israel, without a greater Israel, and every Jew going back to Israel, there can be no end of days. There can be no reappearing of Jesus. And that's dangerous when you get religious fanatics on any side. The majority of Jews want to live peacefully with their Arab neighbors. And I think if you give the Palestinians a sense of pride, they will feel the same way. The last 40 years worked.
Stuart, I hear it loud and clear, and I appreciate your call. I want to get one more clip on a wider front to your point, Jack, about, you know, let the French do it, let somebody else do it. At the GOP debate in Orlando last night, John Huntsman looked all the way out to Afghanistan and Pakistan and said, maybe let's let them do it, made a push for bringing American troops in Afghanistan home.
At the end of the day, folks, only Pakistan can save Pakistan. Only Afghanistan can save Afghanistan.
Yeah.
All that I want right now at this point in history is for America to save America.
For America to save America. David Sanger, an ominous week this week on that front. The leader of peace talks, to the extent that they're there in Afghanistan, the former president of the country, assassinated. You heard a turban and a bomb on the guy's head. He put it right on the man's chest. Boom, up he goes. Isn't the whole current policy, David, based on the idea that we'll kind of talk our way to a better place with the Taliban and get out of there? How can that work in these circumstances?
Tom, you had it slightly backwards. We've announced the timetable on which we're going to get out of there, although I think some American troops will remain, and we're trying to do these negotiations. And it's a very difficult thing to negotiate with an adversary when the adversary knows you're leaving anyway.
But doesn't that bring it right back
from the debate?
Right.
Right. But so then you saw the divisions. You know, we've been fooled once by a negotiator who said he was from the Taliban, who got flown around in negotiations, and it turned out he wasn't. Now the Afghans were fooled over a months-long plot by a Taliban member who said he was negotiating, and he was the one who ended up setting off that turban bomb that killed the head of the Afghan Peace Council. And so the problem that we're stuck with here is that any agreement that is reached with the Taliban now, between now and the time that American and NATO troops are supposed to leave by 2014, there's no assurance that they will respect that the day after American forces are out of their sights. One other thing on the debate. While at least that turned into a fairly well-articulated argument, there was one very good question about what the candidates would do if some of Pakistan's nuclear weapons went loose, a subject you and I have discussed many times before and I've spent a fair bit of time on. Rick Perry's response I've now read three times, and I can't quite figure out what he was saying other than build a relationship with Pakistan. That didn't strike me as probably the best answer of the debate.
In a week when Admiral Mullen is saying Pakistan may have been behind those attacks on the U.S. Embassy right in the heart of Kabul, stand by on that front. That is really thorny. And there's so much we don't even get to here, but the Troy Davis case, so much focus on that this week. More to come on that. Grateful to each of you for being with us this hour. David Sanger in Washington with the New York Times. It's always great to speak with you. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Monroe, editor of CNNpolitics.com, with us here at the Online News Association big gathering in Boston. Brian, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Jack Beatty, great to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.